KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Good evening and welcome to KSL at Night. Tonight, I'm your host, Leah Murray. I'm KSL's resident political science professor from Weber State University. I'm alongside my good friend, Greg Skordas, who's KSL's legal analyst.
Deja vu. We worked together last night.
We worked together last night.
That was a great show.
Yeah, and
tonight's
going to
be just as fun. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So if you missed last night's show, you can always go back and listen to it on KSLpodcast.com or quite frankly, any app where you get your podcast. Just look up KSL at Night. Greg, the monthly jobs report for March is out. So according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, employers have added a little over 300,000 jobs in March. Unemployment rate dropped from 3.9 to 3.8%. Average hourly earnings went up 0.3% and they're up 4% year over year. The average work week rebounded to 34.4 hours a week. And then non-farm payrolls increased by 303,000 in March.
Good news.
Yeah, it feels like it's all
the way across the board. Very good news. Very encouraging news for our country.
Yeah, but neither of us are economists, so we brought in an expert to help us understand these numbers. We've got with us tonight Robert Spendlove, Economic and Public Policy Officer at Zions Bank. Robert, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
All right, so I'm going to tease first and say, it says economists... unexpected. And I actually follow you on LinkedIn, Robert. So today you said these were the numbers and they you said grew above expectations. So my question is, like, why is it that economists keep expecting, do you know what I mean? Something different, right? So my question, kind of the tease, is maybe economists need to rethink how they make their expectations. But also, like, what is it that's, is it just the market? It's defying whatever variables you all put into a model. Just talk to us about that.
Yeah, and you're right. Sometimes good news is just good news, and this report is good news. And so, but where it's kind of surprising economists is if you think about the interest rate environment, the Fed raised those rates way up, and that should slow the economy. And so we've been expecting for the economy to respond to this higher rate environment, and it just is not doing it. And so the previous month, the job growth was 270,000. The expectation was that it would slow down to 200,000, but instead it accelerated not only above the expectation, but above the previous month. So that means even in a very restrictive environment, we continue to see this unexpected growth in the labor market.
So, Robert, given your expertise, what's the reason for that? What's going on that's causing this economy to continue to do well in the face of what was a year ago looking at inflation, interest rates going up? And why is the economy continuing to perform?
There's really only one explanation for this, and that is international migration. And so we are seeing,
really?
You know, this and it's a benefit. It enables the economy to grow above its potential because we're bringing new people into the country. And so we can grow without having. So one of our big struggles is then this low labor force participation. When the pandemic hit, we had 3 million older workers go on the sidelines and they haven't come back in again. And so we've been debating, we've been saying, okay, how do we bring them back into the labor market? Well, what this is showing is that you don't need that resident labor force participation to go up as much if you have people coming into the country that are expanding the overall economy.
So I'm going to just tell you what I was not expecting you to say.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
International migration, Robert. So talk to me about, if you don't mind, and maybe you don't want to speculate too much, does any of the conversation, you know, like what's happening at the border with Mexico affecting this? Are you thinking it's international migration, do you know what I mean, like in other directions? So that whole political, you know, conversation there wouldn't really affect this?
Yeah. And let me just give you the actual numbers. So in February of 2020, there were 28.7 million foreign-born people in the civilian labor force. As of this month, it's 32.2 million. So that's roughly a growth of 3 million foreign-born people in the labor force. And so, you know, there's the politics and then there's the economy.
Yeah.
And the economy doesn't care what politicians say. The economy, employers are saying, we need people, and the economy will always find a way. And that's what we're seeing. So if politicians refuse to address illegal immigration or refuse to process people properly, the economy will still find a way.
So talk to us about some of the other numbers. We talked about employment or unemployment falling. New jobs, we've already talked about 303,000. Hourly earnings rising. Average work week rebounds. Are these all part and parcel of the same really job growth that we're talking about here, part of sort of fallout from that?
Yeah, and this is why, so you saw a positive reaction in the stock market today because of a lot of this narrative. And so again, if these new people coming into the labor force are coming, they tend to be lower wage workers. And so that is one of the reasons why you could have that expansion in the labor force, but also have the unemployment rate dropping and our year-over-year wage growth is slowing a little bit, which we need that wage growth to slow. Right, for the past 4 years, it's been overheating, and the fear is that that would cause higher inflation. But if we see that those hourly earnings coming down, we can have the growth without having the inflationary problem.
Robert, can you talk to us? Sometimes when we do these kind of economic reports, there are different sectors, right, of the economy that have different stories. I like how you said at the beginning of this, good news is just good news, and this is all good news. But is there some sector, if you know what I mean, like big tech or something, right, that we're not seeing growth like this?
Yeah, so our strongest sector was healthcare. Healthcare is doing really well, added about 72,000 jobs. Another really good story is leisure and hospitality, which also grew really strongly. In fact, leisure and hospitality is back to where it was pre-pandemic, so that's a really good story too. Construction grew well. Our slower growth is, you know, kind of in that tech sector, like you were saying. Is still, and when you think about it, that is a very interest rate sensitive area. And so they continue to be kind of contracting and having more struggles than some of those high growing areas.
So, Robert, I want to ask you a follow up on this interest rate. Do you suppose that these numbers and the fact that inflation has slowed a bit might cause the Fed to adjust interest rates sometime this summer?
So it might, and it's a big might. So the critical number is going to come next week. So on Wednesday, we get the actual inflation numbers, and that's the one. Those are the numbers that the Fed is watching really closely. And we have seen that inflation slow over the last year, but there's fear that it could stall out, and we could start to see reacceleration in some of that inflation. And we're seeing that. With gas prices, they're starting to move up again. Home prices might be starting to move up. And so the Fed's going to be watching that really closely. And that's going to be kind of the critical component. But I think the chance of the Fed cutting rates before July is pretty much off the table. So at this point, if the Fed cuts rates, it's going to be in the latter half of this year.
Robert Spendlove, I do always appreciate so much you coming and chatting with us. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Sure. I'm happy to help.
Yeah,
to start the show with some great news.
I know,
Leah.
But I also love how he said, like, the economy will find a way. I mean, to a certain extent, you know, my dad was an economist too, or still, I guess, has an economics degree still. And his whole thing always was Adam Smith said, man, invisible hand, right? So even if politics are not going to deal with things, that invisible hand is going to move stuff around. The economy is going to find a way. Next up, Greg, I want to have a conversation about something near and dear to your heart, which is, you know, skiing.
The Winter Games.
And the Winter Games that are coming up. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. Alongside Leah Murray, I'm your host, Greg Skordis. And Leah, the International Olympic Committee selected Utah as its preferred host for the 2034 Winter Olympics. Now, France, I think, got the 2030 Games. And I don't know what preferred host means. I mean, I guess it means we're right in the...
Well,
right,
why don't we ask
center.
Someone who does
know? So we should
know.
Ask somebody that actually does know. We're honored to have with us a guest who's been with us several times, Fraser Bullock, who is the head of the Utah Olympic Committee. Fraser, thank you for joining us.
So great to be with you again.
And tell us what it means to be a preferred host.
Well, we've been working towards this for years. And what it means is the International Olympic Committee has selected us as the single preferred host for a specific edition of the Games. And so we have been selected as the preferred host for 2034. France is the preferred host for 2030. And what that means, once you enter this phase, we go through a detailed review of our bid. We submit our bid file, which we did on February 29th, over 5,000 pages. And we submitted our guarantees on March 31st. And all these phases are to verify and validate that we would be a good host. So they've said, okay, we really want you to host these games. Now let's do all the paperwork and detailed review to validate it. And once we validate that decision, we'll then have a vote, which will be in July, just before the Paris Games, to select us, and then we'll sign the contract right on the spot.
Wow.
All right, so Fraser, the story that made us call you and want to chat with you was the list of you all released your list of proposed venues. I'm going to tell you that I flipped through it real quick to see where Snow Basin was, because that is my home mountain where I like to ski, and it's in there. Tell us about these 13 venues, noting that maybe I'm the only one who cares only looking for Snow Basin, but there are other places people would care about. How did you all make the choices that you did?
Well, first of all, Snow Basin is fantastic. You go to the top of the downhill there, and it's like you're looking down a cliff, and you just think the athletes point their skis and go straight down. It's just, it's otherworldly.
And it's a tower up there, isn't it, Fraser? I mean, they built that just for this event.
Yeah, the Olympic tram, and it's just, so it'll be spectacular. So the way we've, the difference between 02 and 2034 is that we have 40% more events, but yet we're still going to do it with the same number of venues, and we just have more events in for example, at Park City Mountain Resort, we had half pipe before. Now we're going to add slope style, and slope style is a super cool sport. So we went venue by venue and determined what would be best to fit all the sports in, but there are a couple of notable changes. The first one is that we're going to have Big Air, which is a new event that we didn't have in 02, for both snowboard and freestyle skiing, and we're going to put that right in downtown Salt Lake City. In fact, if you look out the window, you will be able to see the athletes flipping on and doing amazing twists and turns in the air right where Metals Plaza, in combination with Metals Plaza.
Okay, I want to stop you right there, because I'm looking at it. It says Block 85, and I remember they had a lot at the Gallivan Center. So tell our listeners, Fraser, what Block 85 is.
Block 85 is the parking lot northeast of the Delta Center.
Okay.
And it's an empty space, and if it's still available in 2034, that is where we'll have Metals Plaza, but now we'll add Big Air into it. And so we'll have a stadium there, a temporary seating stadium, about 30,000, and suites and things like that, where we'll be able to enjoy Metals Plaza as well as Big Air.
Wow. I mean, that's got to be a huge undertaking. And I remember, Fraser, during the 2002 games, because I was working at Park City at the time, and just the infrastructure that was set up. We had, I think, probably just the slalom that I went and saw there at Park City. But they built, like you say, a 20,000, 25,000 seating stadium just on site there. And you've got to do that for a number of these events. Although, I think as I'm looking through some of these venues, a lot of them are repeat customers, aren't they?
Mostly. Almost all of them are. The one difference is that we will not be doing curling at the ice sheet in Weber County. Is even though that venue is so busy and so successful, it's now too small. And the popularity of curling has exploded. When Team USA won in 2018, curling is so much more popular. So we need more than the 2,000 seats that they can afford up there. We need about 6,000 seats, which we'll be able to do. And we're going to put that in a temporary facility inside the Salt Palace.
So, Fraser, go ahead.
Well, just imagine, right downtown.
That's awesome.
We'll have what we call a live site, which is a 9-block area that'll be a pedestrian mall, so to speak, to go to Metals Plaza and pin trading and on sponsor exhibitions. But you'll have right there, you'll have curling, you'll have figure skating, you'll have short track speed skating, you'll have Big Air, you'll have Metals Plaza, all these things right there together. 2 blocks apart.
All right, but right there, Fraser, you moved, not you, but in what moved was curling out of the ice sheet. And I remember watching curling in that ice sheet last time. And now it's going to be, you know, far away from me, Fraser. And clearly these Olympics are all about me and how I can get
to
events.
She thinks they should all be in Weber County.
But my question is, like, actually a real question is, what does it mean when a venue gets chosen? So is it a really good thing? Does that make sense for Snow Basin to have the Alpine? And then therefore, maybe it's kind of a bad thing that Weber County lost curling. Like, what are the benefits, you know, when you all pick a place for an event to happen?
Well, we think for any community that's able to host an event, it's energizing. And to have the Olympics and Paralympics, in fact, the Paralympics will be at Snow Basin as well, right in your backyard. And to be able to do that, there's some civic pride associated with it.
Yeah.
And so while Weber lost the curling, the good news is you still have what some regard as the premier event of the games, which is the downhill.
The downhill,
the women's downhill.
Yeah, I gotcha.
I mean, it's just iconic. But then we also want to activate each of the communities and create something that we call live sites and look at Ogden and maybe like we did at Park City Main Street or downtown Salt Lake City, have a site in Ogden City where you shut down the street and you can just have a pedestrian mall and TVs and that are broadcasting the games and have each community celebrate participating and touching the games in their own communities.
I love that, Fraser.
Have you picked venues for, and I know this is a little bit not necessarily an event, but for the opening and closing ceremonies? I know we had it at Rice Eccles for 2002. I went to the opening. It was incredible. Where are we going to expect those for 2034?
Those will be at Rice Eccles Stadium, and there are a couple of things to note there. Number one, the stadium has been significantly improved since 2002. And so we can share that with the world, increased capacity, increased hospitality capability on the south end zone. But the key benefit to Rice Eccles Stadium is that the University of Utah housing is where we have the Athletes Village. And so the athletes can just walk from their housing, and we stage them in the Huntsman Center there, and then they just walk over to opening ceremonies. The logistics for the athletes, which are the heart of the games, is really key for us. And it's just a perfect situation.
That was Fraser Bullock, President and CEO of the Salt Lake, Utah Committee for the Games. Thank you, Fraser, for joining us this evening, and congratulations on what you've done so far. Let's close the deal.
Watch for July 24th, Pioneer Day. That's the day when we hope to close the deal.
Thank you for joining us. And Leah, they've got to be happy with this, the last couple of years here in Utah. I mean, we're in April. We're April 5th, and most of our ski resorts still have over 100 inches of snow. So I imagine the IOC is looking at that going, we're in good shape in Salt Lake. We're going to be in good shape.
Yeah, it'll be great.
When we come back after the break, let's go up to north to Ada County, Idaho, Boise. Talk about the Chad Daybell trial. It looks like we're about to pick a jury.
KSL at night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Greg Skordis, and we're talking about interesting things, which, by the way, Greg, sometimes I get notices from KSL News Radio about the most interesting things via text. Do you?
Yeah, I do. And I signed up for it just the other day. So it's been kind of cool because I get these prompts for breaking news every once in a while. I really like it.
Yeah, I feel you should really be in the know, right? And sometimes that can feel overwhelming because your life is other things. But staying in the know is now easy because KSL's got you covered with updates straight to your phone. Just text the word breaking, B-R-E-A-K-I-N-G, breaking, to 57500, and you'll get all the texts just like we do.
Yep, yep.
All right, so Greg, you are our legal analyst at KSL, so you get very excited when there's, you know, like a court case.
A big legal case, yep.
Yeah, and last night we talked a little bit about Chad Daybell and what's happening, so just bring our listeners top of line up to speed.
Okay, so Chad Daybell is the husband of Lori Vallow, who was convicted a year ago for killing her two children, Tylee and JJ. I think everybody knows that. His trial was scheduled for a year later. It's slightly different. He's got an additional homicide case involving his ex-wife, and his case is a capital case, so it's a death penalty case. The jury selection process started this week, and the judge actually set aside 2 weeks for jury selection, thinking it would take a while. Surprisingly, we have a panel to choose from. So we have, they start with several hundred jurors. They're down to about 57, I think. And then Monday, the attorneys get to exercise what are called their peremptory challenges.
All right. So you persuaded me last night, maybe, that there are people on the planet that don't have feelings about Chad Daybell, and that they're going to get a jury that's going to be able to do this without being biased. But I feel like peremptory challenges means they might think there are some people in the room who are biased. Right, Greg?
Well, yeah. Peremptories are really interesting, Leah, because what we do is you get 50 some odd people who you think will be fair. The judge has decided, and both sets of attorneys have decided, this person fits our qualifications. But then you get to deselect. You get to take people off the jury for really any reason you want. Those are called peremptory challenges. And it's sort of a gut feeling sometimes the attorneys do. You can't, for example, let's say you have a client who is of a certain racial minority. You can't deselect every juror that's of that same persuasion. You know what I mean? So if you have a black client, you just take all the black jurors off if you're a prosecutor, thinking they'll be biased one way or the other. That would be inappropriate. Or even if you have a sex case and you take every woman off in terms of your peremptories. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you have to have some level of fairness. But if you take people off, you know, I just don't like the way they were looking at me, or just they've got children about the same age. It makes me uncomfortable. Or they seem to really lean in favor of law and enforcement officers. I'm sort of talking from the defense attorney perspective. Maybe prosecutors, well, this person's got family who have been in trouble. They might be a little more sympathetic, or they don't seem to want to follow the law. You know, so it kind of, it's loosey-goosey, and it's you know, we try to overthink it. Well, we've got this great plan. You don't like people with certain jobs, you know, certain jobs that we kind of don't want, but that's all proven to be hocus pocus.
Right. But you all still engage in the hocus pocus. So, Greg, you were saying that the court kind of expected the jury selection to be about 2 weeks, but it went faster. Why do you think that is?
I think the judge was being cautious in giving 2 weeks. Because it's a capital case, it's more difficult to seat a jury. And in this case, you need 12 jurors. And the judge decided that because the trial is going to go for probably 2 or 3 months, he wants 6 alternates in case one gets sick or gets compromised or in any way they can't serve. So we need 18 jurors. So the judge had to pick a panel of 50 some odd so that the attorneys can take off names so that we can get down to that final 18. I think everyone felt, because of what you said at the very beginning, which is how do you get people that don't know anything about this case? The judge, I think, felt that it might take a little longer than it actually did. Probably just being conservative, they got it done in a week. I think we'll have opening statements next week.
All right. So what do you think we'll learn from, you were saying, I feel like yesterday, that you thought opening statements might be as early as Monday. What do you think we'll hear?
Yeah, most likely Tuesday.
Okay.
Because they still have to exercise their peremptories on Monday. That could take a little while. We have a pretty good idea what the state's opening is going to be because we heard it in Lori's. But the attorneys that represented Lori Vallow in their opening said, we don't think the state has enough evidence. And so just sit back, jury, and hear the case. And at the end of the day, you're going to find that there's not enough evidence. That didn't work. So Chad's lawyers have to present a defense. Now, they don't necessarily have to give their opening remarks next week. They can reserve it until they get to their side of the case. But I expect they probably will. And we'll hear that Chad is going to present a defense and what that is, who his witnesses will be. Lori called no witnesses at all. And maybe even a little bit of a hint as to whether or not Chad's going to take the stand himself.
Yeah, so I have a question for you on that, Greg, because I seem to remember, wasn't it the case that Lori Vallow's attorneys, you were a little put off by them last year, I thought, because they were like, how do you represent this woman? Like, they were a little
They seemed a little apologetic right from the outset.
Right. So a little bit, do you think that Chad Daybell's attorneys aren't taking that posture? Does that make sense? Like, is he going to get better you know, Greg scored his kind of bona fide, like, you know, defense. Will you feel better about these attorneys?
You know, and I shouldn't second guess because I think the attorneys in Lori's case did what they could, but it didn't work. And so I would expect Chad's attorneys can't take that same approach because it didn't work. There is enough evidence. There was enough evidence to persuade the jury. And even though it was a lot of it was circumstantial and sort of people, friends and family and comments that were being made, the jury felt that it was persuasive enough. So I think Chad's lawyers have to take a more aggressive stance, have to call some witnesses, have to rebut their experts, maybe even put Chad on the stand.
Okay. So off the air, you were telling me about some kind of weird motion that was filed last week. What are we talking about?
This is just as strange as it could be. But a lawyer not associated with the case on Friday night at just a few minutes before midnight filed a motion, and it's spelled wrong, but it's a motion to intervene and continue the trial in these proceedings. By the way, motion was spelled wrong, continue was spelled wrong, and trial was spelled wrong. So a motion to intervene and continue the trial in these proceedings. The lawyer filed it. He sent copies of it. So when we do this e-filing now where we have this, you could just plug in, you could file from anywhere you want. It's not like the old days where you had to walk into the court and hand them a piece of paper.
Right.
This lawyer filed this motion to continue the trial and intervene. Really, it's midnight on Friday night before a Monday trial. And he sends copies of it to some lawyers who are not involved in the case. He puts the wrong case number on it. And I think really the judge and the lawyers are like, what's going on? So they immediately convene. The judge files an order sealing the motion. We don't know exactly what it says. The lawyers from both sides agree that that's the way to handle it, that it has to be sealed. Some people did get a copy of it, so it's out there somewhere. But the judge even went so far as to say anyone that has a copy of this motion is precluded from distributing it or talking about it. It's sealed. The judge is not even going to deal with that motion until after this trial's over.
So, pause. Can you file a motion with spelling errors, Greg? I mean, like, doesn't that feel like a min qual on the bar exam? Spell motion correctly.
Yeah, and I, you know, without reading between the lines too much, a motion filed on a Friday night at 11:45, you have to wonder what's going on with this individual. Okay. You know what I mean? Have you ever, and I don't even answer this question, but you send an email to somebody in the middle of the night and the next morning you wake up and go, what did I do? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The motion is so bizarre, so highly inappropriate.
But you don't know what it says. You're not one of the people who got it.
No.
Right. But
you don't file a motion like that. It's not, he doesn't have a dog in the fight. It's not even his case. So yeah, there's nothing appropriate about this motion. The misspellings, the way that it was served. He even lists Lori's name as one of the defendants. The judge has specifically ordered, this is not Lori's case. Don't include her name on anything. So there's so many things about this motion that are so wrong. It had to be upsetting to the parties. The judge has done what I think he had to do, which is seal it up, tell everybody not to talk about it. Let's just try the case.
All right. So we'll just keep an eye on that, Greg, and we'll talk about it later. Next up on KSL at Night, housing, obviously, has been a big issue or concern for so many people in Utah and probably all over the world. KSL News Radio's Amy Kobabe has been looking into the housing market in Utah for her conference special. She'll join us after the break.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
We're back on KSL at Night alongside Leah Murray. I'm your host, Greg Skordis. And Leah, this week marks the 194th annual General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Starts tomorrow. So we've been previewing some of the special coverage being put together by KSL News Radio. If you recall, two nights ago, we had Debbie Dujanovic on. She's doing a segment on a young man with bipolar disorder who had an incredibly bad breakdown at the Salt Lake Airport in January of this year. Last night, we had a little more fun interview with Jessica Lowell from KSL Radio, who also talked to us about the cold plunge, if you recall. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of fun with that, just jumping in the cold bathtub or the cold water and how that refreshes you. Tonight, we have with us our own Amy Kobabe, who is always generous with her time, who's going to talk to us about something different. And before we get to that, I want to back up a little bit, because when we started the program tonight, we talked with Robert Spendlove, who talked to us about the economy and the fact that jobs have gone better, employment, a lot of jobs were created, unemployment has gone down to a new low, wages have gone up, hourly rates have gotten better, but he was a little concerned about the fact that the housing market was still continuing to go higher and higher, and the interest rates are probably not going to come down. So I think this dovetails really nicely in what Kobabe is going to talk to us about. Sorry, Amy, which is the housing market.
Thank you
for joining us.
Thank you so much. That's a perfect introduction, because I just looked up Redfin has the median home price in Utah for the last month. It was $542,000. And that's near where it even peaked just a few years ago in 2022. So we're still seeing those really high prices, and that impact on people is what I really dove into with this conference special: impact on selling homes, buying homes. I even spoke to one woman. She's a renter, and she and her husband are trying to get out of that situation, and it's just been really difficult for them. So it's not just numbers. You know, a lot of times we talk about housing and we just talk about the numbers, but this is really impacting people and their lives.
Amy, can you tell us why, like, how do you pick a topic? Does that make sense for special conference coverage? Is this, did someone assign that to you, or you have feelings based on your own experience?
This is something, great question, that that I've heard a lot of people talking about. It's what my friends and I are talking about. I've now reached that point in my life, I guess. But so I pitched this as an idea, and was grateful that the higher ups above me, editors, said, hey, that is a good idea. Talk about that. And I think that having that curiosity kind of helps, because I get to ask the questions, you know, hey, how much did you buy your home for?
Yeah.
Because it's something we all want to ask. And I did actually ask one woman who, first time home buyer, she bought her home and paid about the median home price, or at least it was listed for that. She paid a little bit less, and is happily living in her new home. But she told me that she was delusional when she first started the process of looking, and had to really change her expectations, because, you know, what she could afford was either in a neighborhood she never wanted to live, or it required a lot of work that she just couldn't put into it. So it's a topic that that I was really interested in, and I think I'll continue to be interested in kind of how it develops, because it's one of those that our leaders are talking about, and they're looking at, you know, some reform there. I don't dive into the reform as much, but maybe in a future special we can do that.
Amy, it seems like in Utah our house prices, house values continue to rise. I mean, this market in Utah has just been red hot for some period of time. Interest rates are continuing to be pretty high. It seems like, notwithstanding the good news we have about the economy, the bad news for young home buyers, young people who really want to buy a home, is it's still a little bit out of reach for a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The family that's renting that I spoke to, they really talked a lot about how, you know, they both have good careers. They're well established in their careers. They're making more than they've ever made in their entire lives. And they really expected that at this point they wouldn't be looking at, you know, renting a townhome. But that's what they're able to afford. And she said, we don't want to be house poor, but we also, you know, we want our kids to have room to grow with a yard. And where they're living right now, they just don't have that. It also kind of changed the perspective for her. We have a cut here on, you know, just looking forward to the future.
I mean, we've talked about a lot of things, is like, what as parents can we do to help her in her future, you know, because I don't think it will get better. Like, I think that it will just continue to get worse.
What do you hope? Amy, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, what do you hope listeners get out of your special? Does that make sense? When they're hearing the stories that you are bringing, how do they, like, what, you know, what would be the top of line takeaway?
I think just different perspectives was kind of the goal here. So I spoke to a realtor, I spoke to a home builder, a renter, and a new home buyer. And all of those perspectives are something that they bring something unique to the table. It's not just the governor saying that this is an issue. And so I think that if you're in a home right now, or if you're looking for a home, you know, this might expand your kind of perspective on the process, where it sits in Utah, and, you know, maybe some of the solutions as well, as far as, you know, how can we get to where it's just a little bit easier, a little bit more like part of a foreseeable future for more people.
Amy, we had a legislator on last year, right during the legislative session, and we had the Utah Housing Director, I think his name is Dave Damshin, on this year, and they both talked about this first-time homebuyer program that Utah started that really gives people a foot in the door. Listening to the last soundbite that you had, the woman said, I don't expect it to get better, but it seems like they are trying to do some things in Utah. Maybe people just aren't aware of that, or maybe there just aren't enough new homes and new construction for people to get into that. Were you able to address those issues at all with people and say, hey, there is some light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, a little bit. It seems like, just you said, it's not something that people are really aware of. And maybe that's something that, you know, they need to incorporate in these programs, is some public outreach and marketing. I did, though, talk with the realtor, Thomas Wright, who's really sharp on this and has done it for a while. He talked about the fact that there's just not enough homes on the market right now. And it's been like that for several years now, that's also driving up demand. And so if you're in the market, you know, you've got a lot of competition with others. It's not even just the affordability, it's the competition that a lot of people are struggling with in getting to that home that, you know, sometimes there's one or two in a really desirable neighborhood that are less than $500,000. And so there's a lot of competition there that could drive that home up even further in those prices in the future, you know, in that neighborhood. So that's also at play. And I didn't dive in as deep into some of those programs, but yeah, that's one option that people are looking at and using. And hopefully that can alleviate. I think it's just going to take a lot of time to get there where those are maybe top of mind.
Amy, tell our listeners when and how they can listen to your program.
Perfect. My favorite question. So this will be Saturday, tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. And if you miss it, because I know Saturday is busy, you can go to our website, kslnewsradio.com, or go to our podcast. That's Conference Conversations. And just look for it there. It's called Unwelcome Home.
And that was a KSL News Radio reporter Amy Kobabe. You're not with ABC News. Amy, thank you so much. We wish you could be here in the studio with us next time, however, okay?
Okay, sounds great, Greg. We'll do it then.
And we might come back after the break. It's been only 2 days since we talked about an earthquake in Taiwan. But today, there was another one, this time on the east coast of our very own country. We're going to talk about that after the break.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Greg Skordis. Greg, this morning, my cool new feature on my phone, I got a text from KSL News Radio telling me about an earthquake in New York City. Did you get that text?
Yes, I did. And this, unfortunately, fell right on the heels of a bad earthquake in Taiwan just a couple days early. It was a 7.4. This one was a little bit less, but it was kind of interesting to be able to get that information really close to the time it occurred.
Yeah, right out of the gate. So if you want to be someone like me and Greg who has all the information right immediately as it's happening, you want to stay in the know, you have got to text the word breaking, B-R-E-A-K-I-N-G, to 57500, and you'll get all these texts. So yeah, so I wake up to this text from KSL News Radio telling me about this 4.8 earthquake that hit this morning on the East Coast at 10:23 a.m., which is 8:23 our time, which now makes me think I must have been awake longer because I did not wake up at 8:23. So I probably saw that text coming in in from KSL News Radio a little bit later in the morning than I had remembered it. This earthquake sent tremors from Philadelphia to Boston. I'm going to tell you what, Greg, my dad lives about 3 hours north of New York City, and he was sitting at a table. My nieces are visiting my family there, and they were playing Yahtzee this morning at the kitchen table, and all of a sudden it started to shake so much that my stepmother actually thought a tree had fallen down, right? So that, to give you an idea, 3 hours away from where the epicenter was, they were feeling shaking.
And the epicenter was in New Jersey, about 40 miles west of New York City. I mean, that was that had to wake up a lot of people. That's a huge population area. And let's hope that it didn't cause much damage or certainly lost any life.
A little bit so far, we don't have to hope. The New York police have said there's no immediate reports of damage. You know, the airports in the area, and there are a lot of airports near New York City, and many people have probably flown in or out of those airports at some point. All of those issued a ground stop for like a minute. Does that make sense? Like in the immediate aftermath.
Right.
But then all flights got moving again, and they were getting out of New York City. The mayor, Eric Adams, said there were no reports of any major impacts or injuries, at least so far at the time that we're recording this, when we were kind of looking at the stories. And maybe my favorite part, because y'all know that I am someone who grew up in New York, I'm talking to my dad about this earthquake, and my dad's like, yeah, you know, it's an earthquake, we'll be fine. And the governor of New York kind of echoed the same way that New York just kind of responds to things. Governor Kathy Hochul said, fortunately, here in the state of New York, we are masters of disaster and we know how to handle this.
Yeah, I mean, earthquake in New York, like, we've seen worse.
Yeah, it's like, no drama, man. We'll just keep rolling. But what's interesting is President Biden was, so today Biden was over in Baltimore because they had a not natural disaster, right? When
the bridge broke,
The boat went right into that bridge. So he's over in Baltimore making sure things are being seen, that people feel heard from Baltimore. But even in the midst of all of that, he's on the phone today with New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy to make sure that if anything was happening, that the federal government was paying attention.
Yeah, and so this is a magnitude 4.8 earthquake. And you have to wonder, Leah, had this occurred 50 years ago, before we had all these amazing building codes and regulations and just the engineering that's now in buildings, if we'd have seen something worse. But like you say, a 4.8 earthquake, that's something that's going to wake you up. But in New York, when we've got so much so much infrastructure in place to be ready for something like this, they dealt with it and everything's fine.
Yeah, they just kind of move on, right? So I was thinking about earthquakes because I do know that we live, like, so the deal is in New York, there are always tremors because if you live somewhere where the tectonic plates are bumping, you're going to get tremors. Most of the time you don't notice it.
Right.
When we get an earthquake, right, it is the case that a lot of pressure's built up, and then the tectonic plates have basically exceeded the friction between them. And so, boom, right? Like it is a seismic release of energy. That energy passes through the earth. It causes the ground to shake. And that's how we get an earthquake. I don't know if you remember during COVID, this was like so interesting. COVID happened, everything shuts down.
Right.
We're teaching like via Zoom, and then there was an earthquake. and I remember thinking, I think Armageddon's happening, right? The end of the world. Here it is, plague, and then an earthquake. You know, it can be very scary, right? Like you're just, all of a sudden the ground starts moving.
And to me, Leah, this one is a little bit scary. I know that we're talking about everyone handled it, everyone's doing just fine, but it fell right on the hills of a bigger earthquake on the opposite side of the planet, pretty much, the one in Taipei, Taiwan. It was a 7.4, significantly more than a 4.8.
Right.
And same thing, the tectonic plates are moving. You wonder if there's some shift, there's something going on. I mean, you hope that there's not an earthquake in Australia tomorrow, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or Western Europe on Sunday. You know, that this isn't something going on, maybe two events that occurred really close in time, but on different sides of the world. I mean, that was the only thing that troubled me about it, is we had a big earthquake story yesterday, big earthquake story today.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. I would have expected, how do I say, I kind of expect there's going to be an earthquake where we live, right, Greg? Because we are along a fault right here. So there are tectonic plates beneath us that are thinking about letting loose with some seismic energy. And I, you know, one of the things I'm always thinking about is, so what are you supposed to do to prepare?
Right.
I don't really think we get a lot. Like, you kind of have an idea that you're on a fault line, right? So you know that this might happen. There's not going to be notice. Does that make sense? So it's like...
Very little, if any.
Yeah, right. Like if people live in Tornado Alley, they get a message. There's right. a tornado coming. I think if you're going to have an earthquake, it's just going to hit. So I think what you're supposed to do is just be prepared for that kind of disaster. Like if we got an earthquake here, I live with a Boy Scout, right? One of his merit badges was emergency
earthquake preparation.
Not
there
earthquake,
you go.
Earthquake, but emergency, right. which applies for earthquakes. And so you've got to have like an emergency kit. You've got to have a fire extinguisher. You've got to have extra doses of medications. You've got to have some first aid supplies. You do like safety stuff for Powder Mountain.
Right.
Do you have a sense of like, is there anything you would add for people who are listening if the earthquake hits, if what you are dreading happens and we got our earthquake tomorrow, what should they have in their house?
Well, I think the things that you talked about, but you should have food. You should have plenty of water. I mean, it's we all rely so much on just opening the tap and having some water, but it doesn't hurt to have some standby water, something that's there in bottles or whatever you store it in, just enough to get you by for a couple of days. Because if an earthquake hits and it messes up the water supply, you don't want to be without water. I think that's important. You know, and I also think since we have cell phones now, you know, landlines in the past would break down and you don't remember when we had landline phones, but you know, the communication is so important during these times. And we do a good job of making sure that there are avenues of communication that can continue. So being able to get to your cell phone, be able to have some sort of charger that may not require electricity at that time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just being prepared for that type of thing.
I wonder, Greg, do you think people should have like a radio with an antenna, right? Because a little bit, I think... You know, what happened, so for example, in New York when it was 9/11, actually the cell towers came down.
Yeah.
So if you were relying on a mobile phone, you were in trouble. Actually, a landline might have done more help for you,
point.
Right?
Yeah.
And a lot of us don't have landlines. So then I kind of wonder if the cell towers come down and we don't have Wi-Fi, like how would I know what was happening? And maybe what we all need is to have like a transistor radio.
Yeah, a battery operated radio,
yeah,
something
right?
that you don't have to plug in case the power goes out. Good point. Yeah, a remote communication device other than a cell phone just in case would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. No, and I think it seems ridiculous except that I watch the Jazz now via an antenna. This is the
only
way I can get it. So I actually have something that's antenna driven in my house at the moment.
You know, a lot of people now, because of power outages and whatnot, have generators. I don't have one at my house. My wife is always telling me we need to buy a generator.
Yeah.
But I I'm not trying to sell generators, but it seems like people that have those are really ready for things that happen like this.
Yeah.
Just a little, I think they're powered by some, you know, gas or propane or something like that. But
yeah.
Boy, you just turn it on. You're ready to go. You can still light up your house. You can still do what you need to do, notwithstanding what's going on around you with respect to power.
Yeah. Next up on KSL at Night, Greg, did you know that there's something called a totality coming on Monday?
I didn't know that.
Well, we're going to get into it. You'll learn all the things you need to know. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
You're back with us on KSL at Night. I'm Greg Skordis alongside Leah Murray. And Leah, Monday is what you called the totality.
Doesn't that sound like a great movie?
Yeah, it sounds like a great movie. But what happens is this. The moon passes in front of the sun to the point where it completely covers the sun. That's called totality. And the world becomes dark. Now, it's not for the entire world. There's a stretch. And it starts at 11:07 a.m. in Mexico, travels sort of north and easterly up through Maine, where it hits Maine about 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, which is 3:30 p.m. Eastern time. And it's really kind of an interesting sort of swath through that eastern part of the United States. So to help us break that down and maybe understand the importance or just the significance of it, because I just think it's cool, because we're not going to have another one for 20 years, is Patrick Wiggins, NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador to Utah. Patrick, thank you for joining us this evening.
Happy to do it, and greetings, people of Earth.
Yes, and so tell us about this. Tell us about this event.
We've got a sun eclipse coming up on Monday. Now, unfortunately for here in Utah, it's only going to be like a half eclipse, right? You've got to be somewhere else. Matter of fact, I was planning on Dallas, but it looks like it's going to be cloudy there. But we're always fighting with the weather. But yeah, the moon is going to move in front of the sun, and depending on where you are, part of it will be covered up, and in some places, the whole thing will be covered up.
Yeah, I remember, I feel like we had one of these, was it, Patrick, 7 years ago? Because I, right, am I remembering
most
that?
Most recently, yeah, we had one last October. If you happen to find yourself down around Delta, Richfield, that sort of thing, it was almost a total. The last complete total eclipse of the sun that happened anywhere near here was 2017.
Right. That's what I remember, because I remember standing on my campus, Patrick, and looking down, and like the shadows were in the shape of a crescent. Right. So, you know, which I just thought, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen. Just like the sun.
And I'm glad that you mentioned looking down. You know, safety first. I like to kid around a lot when I talk astronomy or anything for that matter. But don't look at the sun unless you are properly protected. From here in Utah, no matter where you are in the state, it's not going to be total. So you've got to have those geeky glasses. There are other ways of doing it as well. Or as you did, look down.
Yeah,
light coming through trees will form little eclipses all over the ground. A colander out of the kitchen. Take that out, hold it up, let the light shine through it onto the ground or onto a piece of paper.
That's interesting.
Look through the holes yourself, and you'll see little eclipses.
I love that. No, and it's so cool. I'm wondering, could I grab my cell phone, Patrick, take it? So I'm not looking at the sun, but could I take a picture of the eclipse with my cell phone?
I don't know what that would do to the chip.
Certain astronomy
cameras, you can literally burn things by looking at the sun. If you got an old phone, you know, I guess you could try it.
Oh, I like that. It's an experiment.
What you could do, if you got the glasses, put the glasses in front of the lens, and then that would be perfectly okay. So try it that way.
Okay.
Put your pair of glasses on your cell phone, Leah, and take a picture of the total eclipse. Patrick, talk to us about a picture of you doing that. Yeah,
that's right.
Talk to us about the significance of this. Is it more than just an interesting phenomena?
Well, it depends on who you are. You know, people that are really into studying this, that travel the world, they're called umbrophiles or eclipsomaniacs. You know, I've been to 7 of these things around the world, and they're a very special event, totality. What we're going to get here, I like to refer to it as kind of like kissing a sibling. There's no magic to it, if you will. But, you know, these have been going on for, you know, billions of years, basically. And we're really lucky. As far as we know, we are the only planet in our solar system that ever gets total eclipses of the sun the way that we get here. So it's kind of magical. It's kind of fun. It's all science, of course, but it's just a fun thing to, in effect, see the solar system in motion. Watch as the moon slowly creeps across the face of the sun.
Why would that be that we're the only planet in the solar system? Because our moon is the right size, or it just...
Yeah. It's kind of a trick here, because the sun is like 400 times farther away than the moon, but the moon, its size is such that it just is the right size at this time. Now, the moon is slowly getting further and further away from the Earth. Not in a human lifetime are you going to notice it, but eventually it'll get so far away that it won't be big enough in the sky to cover the sun. So right now, where we are now, and for the next probably a million years or so.
I was going to say, it won't be during our lifetimes,
these
right?
Eclipses. Oh, no, not during. The moon is receding at about the rate that your fingernail grows. So very, very slowly, right? But it just happens that it's this way. We've got spacecraft sitting on the surface of Mars, and they see eclipses of the sun by the little worlds, Phobos and Deimos, that go around Mars, but they're not big enough. And so it just looks like a spot moving across the face of the sun. But we're lucky here where the moon is just the right size and just the right distance that we do get to see these total eclipses every now and then. Now, by the way, if you missed this one coming up on Monday, there's another one coming up in October. All you got to do is travel to South America.
But I'm getting...
These things, actually, they're not rare. We get eclipses pretty much every year. But the thing is, you've got to travel to see most of them. We're lucky on this one, and last October and in 2017, where we were relatively close. But some of them, again, happen on the other side of the planet. That's why I've done a lot of traveling during my life. I'd like to see these things, and sometimes you got to travel a long ways to do it.
Yeah, so Patrick, I was thinking, I've got my younger son is a budding astronomer, and he's very interested in this kind of stuff. And in October, he went out with my husband, and my husband looked right up at the sun, right, of course, that you're not supposed to do, and then was convinced he destroyed his eyes and all sorts of exciting things. But my question is, if you're a parent with a budding astronomer at home and you want to be like ready for Monday, are there, Patrick, places you could go? Is there like a website parents could go to? Or, and maybe it's not just parents with young kids, but it could also just be grown-ups who are interested.
There are several places online. NASA, I know, is doing one, but other places as well, where they're going to be following the eclipse. So you can watch it on TV, especially if you're interested in totality, or if you're in a place that's cloudy and you're not able to see it that way. So, yeah, on TV. But that kind of takes some of the magic away, if at all possible. If you've got the glasses or some other safe way, and I got to keep stressing that. I've got a friend that's my same age and is 70s. He damaged one eye when he was a kid looking at the sun, and he's had to live his whole 70 plus years with this bad eye. So please don't risk it. It's just a partial eclipse. We've got a total eclipse of the sun coming to Utah, well, in 2045. So that's a ways off. But, you know, again, they happen all the time. If you really get into this, if you want to travel, you can see them. But please be safe. I don't want to hear stories on Tuesday morning of people going to the doctor with bad eyes. Just be safe. That's all I can say.
Patrick, you introduced our listeners to two new words, which are essentially eclipse-ologists. Yeah, eclipse. Tell us those words again, and I take it you're in that category.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I literally, until the weather started looking bad, planning on just jumping in the car on Sunday and just a little drive to Dallas to see this eclipse and then drive right back again. We do that. Now, I've seen seven, which to a lot of people probably seems like a big number, but I've met people that have seen over 30.
Yeah.
And people that are really into this, travel. They got more money than I do, or they work for some place that does that. So, yeah, the eclipsomaniac, that's one that I've used for years. One that I've heard more recently is an umbraphile, umbra being the shadow that's cast on the earth during an eclipse.
And so if you're
into that, umbraphile. So yeah, that's a couple of, or you could just call us nerds. I'm perfectly happy with that, too. I'm a science nerd, and I admit it.
Thank you for joining us, Patrick. And we'll be watching for the eclipse, and hopefully I'll be around for the 2045 one.
Yeah, very good. All right. Talk to you later then.
A little bit of a shortened show tonight, Leah, because the Jazz are playing right after our show. So stay tuned for the Jazz. Go Jazz. I forget who they're playing tonight. I think it might be the Clippers, but they've got an 8:30 p.m. showing right after ours. So we're a little bit of a shortened version, but we'll be back next week at our normal time, 7 to 9. Join us then.